We don't want to have the state of Alaska in one of the strongest, if not the strongest, physical position of any state in the nation, and then just, you know, not flex that muscle.
Lawmakers anticipate a healthy price tag for the capital budgets bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 6th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a discovery at the University of Alaska Anchorage leads to a big research grant.
I mean, right now, talking about it, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up just like it did that day. And I said, holy cow!
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
With only 12 more days expected in this year's session, legislators are beginning to get edgy about this year's capital projects budget. Today's scheduled release of the plan was canceled. That leaves a problem. Most members haven't seen any part of it yet, and they don't know if the scattered information they're hearing is complete or even correct. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Last year, the legislature decided on a bare-bones capital projects budget, spending only $280 million from the state's general fund. Nothing but the essentials and nothing for lawmakers' home districts. This year, oil revenue's better, the outlook is good, and the finance chairman anticipate making up for last year's drought. The absence of information has not stopped spending debate, however. Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan, a finance committee member, admits that he's working from the unofficial, unsupported hallway talk. But he expects the bill will be bigger than anyone thinks it'll be.
There's discussions about whether or not we actually have the kind of money that can support capital budget numbers in the 800 millions, which is what the current rumor, and I emphasize rumor, is that this is going to cost.
House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Republican from Kenai, says he doesn't know what to expect from the Senate either. It's all limited to conversations he's had, nothing specific. However, he doesn't think it's a problem yet.
Got a couple of weeks. Seems like it's always the capital budget's the last budget that passes, as we know. And, you know, with a couple of weeks left, I think we still have time to negotiate what the members on our side feel is a fair capital budget, and also what the Senate will consider a fair capital budget.
The Senate finance co-chairs are previewing their budget as a jobs bill, providing money that was not available last year for projects that people need. Sitka's Bert Stedman says the state will see an anti-recession measure and an increase in the state's savings plan, and an attempt to catch up on overdue maintenance on state property, and a bond package for some larger items. He says Alaskans should welcome that approach.
We don't want to have the state of Alaska in one of the strongest, if not the strongest, physical position of any state in the nation, and then just, you know, not flex that muscle in down economic times. So we want to put projects on the street. We want to try to access some of our natural resources, try to create some jobs.
That isn't enough to satisfy budget hawks like Dugan, however. He says it's also very possible that the plan will become a feeding frenzy.
Either the majorities in the House and the Senate do a deal before this bill ever comes over to us, and it's taken care of, or there's going to be a big fight.
The other finance co-chair, Lyman Hoffman, says state revenue projections will show an additional $855 million available during the budget period that was not anticipated at the start of the session. And he wants to set aside $200 million of it for savings. Meanwhile, legislators are waiting to see what will be done with the rest of that money. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A team of researchers at the University of Alaska Anchorage are working on a study that could eventually help make drinking water safer in the U.S. They recently won a grant from the National Institutes of Health to look into the effects of the chemical perchlorate on the health of a fish called a stickleback. The team has already made some startling discoveries. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
A day in the lab may not sound like a thrilling way to pass the hours, but Rick Bernhardt has a story to prove it can be. On a sunny day 6 years ago, Bernhardt was doing early research on how perchlorate affects stickleback. In the lab, he was isolating a group of males from the rest of the fish. At least he thought they were males. It didn't take him long to realize something wasn't quite right.
And so I had these females that began acting like males. I thought they were males until they became gravid. Their abdomen started to swell, and you know, I suspected they were eggs, but they behaved like males.
It was a curious discovery, and Bernhardt wanted to know more. So when one of the fish died, he cut it open. He saw the eggs clearly, and then looked a little closer and saw shimmery sperm, too. He had found a hermaphrodite, or intersex stickleback.
Now, these are genetically male or female, like us. They don't do this. And I mean, right now, talking about it, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up just like it did that day. And I said, holy cow. And so, you know, Frank's figuratively grabbing me by the shirt collar saying, okay, what are you going to do? You know, settle down and let's make a plan.
That plan included more research, which eventually led to the current grant from the National Institutes of Health. Bernhardt is working with lead researchers and UA professors Frank von Hippel and Lauren Buck, along with PhD student Buck Furin. They have $2.8 million to study how perchlorate exposure skews the development of sticklebacks. The chemical is often found at military sites because it's used to make rocket fuel and in artillery. Several states have drinking water standards for perchlorate, but the chemical isn't regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. Frank von Hippel says it's widespread in the environment.
It's found throughout the lower 48 states. It's found in drinking water, in milk at the grocery store. It's found in lettuce grown in Southern California. It's found in all kinds of food and water. A recent CDC study found that virtually all Americans have perchlorate in their urine, and so we're all getting exposed to it.
The sticklebacks in von Hippel's study are exposed to different levels of perchlorate in a small windowless room on campus. The minnow-like fish swim in dozens of aquaria stacked on shelves. PhD student Buck Furin is in charge of this part of the experiment.
All these aquaria are full of stickleback, but I have three different treatments that I'm using. There's control fish, and then I'm exposing some fish to 30 parts per million and some fish to 100 parts per million. I started off with about 1,600 fish, and now it's down to around 400 fish, I think.
The university is now building a new stickleback lab where the team will be raising several thousand more fish for the newest phases of the study. The small fish may not look like it has much in common with humans, but von Hippel says the stickleback is a remarkably good model for human health, partly because it shares 70% of our genes.
If perchlorate is affecting a particular gene in a fish, chances are it's also affecting that gene in humans. We share the same endocrine system, the same hormone system. So if perchlorate is affecting the way hormones are working in the fish, chances are it's also affecting the way the hormones are working in people. So we think this is a really great model to understand the effects of perchlorate on human health throughout development.
There are lots of chemicals like perchlorate that can disrupt hormones. And principal investigator Lauren Buck says that's part of what makes this study timely.
If you look at the incidence of reproductive disorders worldwide, and in particular in developed nations, they're skyrocketing. So the fact that, yeah, we're just studying one of many chemicals out there that can cause disruptions in reproductive development, it is frightening. And it's something that I think as citizens, as Americans, that we need to be concerned about. And we need more research to really understand, firstly, how individual chemicals impact our physiology, and then secondarily, how these operate potentially in a cocktail.
The researchers hope their work will eventually help the EPA set safe levels for perchlorate. But Professor von Hippel says politics are involved. As soon as the chemical is federally regulated, the military could be liable for billions of dollars in cleanup costs. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Citykins, kids learn the art of preparing an important subsistence food.
It's slimy, it's gooey. Well, the fat is hard at first, but then once you get hold of it, it gets liquidy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
State officials say they have a written agreement with cruise lines to drop a lawsuit challenging Alaska's passenger head tax. That's if lawmakers reduce the charge by nearly 60%. That and other details of the cruise tax issues came up during two legislative meetings yesterday. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
State Department of Law officials spoke at House and Senate Finance Committee hearings on the head tax bills. Assistant Attorney General Chris Pogue says the agreement is not finalized, but it's close.
They've had terms on our desk for quite some time. We've been carefully reviewing those. This morning at 6 o'clock, I sent them back to their lawyer. So I would say in good faith, we're making good progress. We should have the agreement executed hopefully by the end of the week. Rest assured, we'll have that agreement executed before this bill, if it passes, were to end up on the governor's desk.
Attorney General Dan Sullivan says the state will defend the tax in court if lawmakers do not reduce the charge and the lawsuit proceeds. The tax cut bills before lawmakers would reduce the $46 per person passenger fee to $34.50. Provisions further reducing the tax for passengers stopping in Juneau and Ketchikan, which have their own fees, would take it down to $19.50. Tax supporter Chip Toma of Juneau suggested a compromise approach. It would reduce the fee to about $39 for all passengers, including those stopping in Juneau and Ketchikan.
Fair taxation is a good thing for all industries, whether it be oil and gas, whether it be mining, whether it be cruise ships. And this tax that we have right now, I think, is working. And we can have a lowering of that tax by perhaps 15%. But let's not do a double dip. Let's not do a cap and skim where we're taking off the money at the bottom, too.
The Parnell administration proposed the bills last month after meeting with cruise lines. Those lines pulled three ships out of state waters this year and two more next season. They blame the head tax and other parts of the voter-approved cruise ship initiative for driving them away. Curtis Thayer of the State Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development says fewer ships mean fewer jobs.
We don't know for certain how many family-run small businesses that serve visitors will weather these declines. We do know the estimated job loss for the next 2 years is near 5,000 jobs, and the situation is unsustainable. These jobs feed our families and fuel our economy. They're jobs in multitude of Alaska small businesses owned and operated by Alaskans and their families.
Lawmakers questioned several provisions of the bills but took no action. More hearings are planned. Passenger fee supporters say the worldwide economic downturn caused the changes in cruise ship schedules, not the head tax. But both committees heard from numerous tour business owners and managers who said cutting the tax would increase their business. Sitka's Fred Reeder of Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska told lawmakers the industry cuts have hit his town.
In Sitka alone, we are looking at job losses, well over 100 people, and economic losses in the millions of dollars to local businesses. It will be so bad in Sitka this summer that I cannot even hire one of my own sons. I have no job for him.
Municipal officials also told lawmakers the passenger drop, estimated at 15% this year, will cost millions of dollars in local sales tax revenues. Head tax proceeds have totaled about $40 million a year, although they're expected to drop this season due to lower passenger numbers. Part of the revenue goes directly to port communities, with the rest distributed by the legislature. The funds have mostly been used for improvements to docks and nearby facilities. Cruise Ship Initiative author Joe Geldof of Juneau says the tax should remain substantial until those projects are complete.
You don't want to be in a situation where you've reduced, then skimmed, and you short yourself, this committee and the entire legislature, with funds to address very real needs in places like Wrangell, Homer, Kodiak, and our other port communities.
The Parnell administration's bills also call for income tax credits for cruise lines contributing to the state's tourism marketing campaign. That provision has substantial opposition in the legislature. The House and Senate committees have put that provision in separate bills. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The House Education Committee heard testimony from the state's new director for rural education, Phyllis Carlson, on Friday. Carlson's role is a new position within the Department of Education. She grew up in the Chignik Bay and Kodiak area and attended the school in Chignik when there were 30 students enrolled. She's been on the job for about 3 months and says she'll be working on the state's cultural standards developed by rural educators. She says some districts may not be sure of how to apply these cultural mandates.
In some cases, they're probably using them more than they realize they are, but our hope is to put some more formal focus around that and help the districts and the teachers be more place-based or culturally appropriate for the students and the communities they're serving.
Carlson says the cultural standards are not content, but rather a way of teaching through local knowledge. She says at the end of the month, she'll be meeting with a group of educators called the Alaska Native Education Association.
They are Native teachers. They are the folks who created the cultural standards group, and so I will be going back to them to talk about their vision and their intentions more specifically as we work on implementing those standards.
Also at the hearing was the governor's rural advisor, John Moeller. Moeller said he's hearing from rural parents and educators who are hopeful that the governor's proposal for merit-based scholarships will gain approval in the legislature.
This week alone, I had folks from St. Mary's in my office, members of the school board, superintendent, that were very grateful for the introduction of this program. Yesterday, I was up in Gaucona, where I heard from parents and educators, and they too expressed their gratitude for its introduction.
Galena School Superintendent Jim Smith testified about what he sees as a growing need to consider more regional hubs for education beyond just Galena, Mount Edgecombe, and Nenana. He said currently his school is educating 4,400 students. Another 10,000 Alaska students are taking distance education courses.
In our ID program, we have sophomores who graduate with their high school credits and college credits. And they're off to do other things, you know. Their focus is in education and instruction, their family supports that, and they're out early and on to a life of pretty good experiences. So anything is possible. We just shackle ourselves by saying everything should look this way, and this should be this way in every community and village in the state of Alaska, and it economically isn't going to be practical.
This week, a joint session of House and Senate Education Committees will look at the court case Moore versus the State of Alaska. Judge Sharon Gleason says the state is failing to show it's making good on a court order to improve education in chronically underperforming rural schools. She ordered the state to show within the next 2 months how it plans to improve students' skills in math, writing, reading, and science in some school districts where the state has intervened.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Fairbanks police have jailed four massage parlor operators on prostitution and related charges. The women were arrested at three businesses, Jade's Therapeutic Massage, Spa Asia, and April's Massage last Friday. A fifth masseuse eluded arrest. Fairbanks police investigator Jim Gibson says police sent undercover officers into the massage parlors last month and illegal activity was confirmed.
We purchased eight different massages using our undercover officers, and all eight massages within probably, I'd say, 10 minutes of the massage, they were all offered various sexual acts in exchange for money. So the officers declined that, ended up leaving. We were able to get warrants for the places.
The women jailed, three from Korea and one from China, are legally in the U.S. and have California driver's licenses. Gibson says it's unclear if they're part of a larger operation.
Part of our investigation led us to a website that I think worldwide is used by these massage parlors, Asian massage parlors. People have submitted reviews for these local massage parlors in there that describing exactly what they received. And I mean, you can just go to this website and pick wherever you are in the world, basically, and find out how many massage parlors that offer these services are in that area.
Gibson says the three Fairbanks businesses implicated in the sting are on the website, as well as a dozen similar massage parlors in Anchorage. In the aftermath of the Chilean earthquake in February, Alaska remained under a tsunami advisory for most of the day. But for a brief period in the early morning, the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center's computer system posted a false all clear. KCAW's Robert Woolsey was one broadcaster who reported the false message. He talked recently with emergency authorities to find out what went wrong that morning.
It seems like we were all still reeling from the earthquake in Haiti when the magnitude 8.8 quake struck late at night on Friday, February 26th in Chile. The quake and the expected tsunami were already headline news in the United States just as we were getting up. Civil defense authorities in Hawaii were preparing early for coastal evacuation.
Because they're not supposed to be there anyway. Frankly, it is a mandatory evacuation.
We are now looking at a shot of Hilo Bay.
The warning system, in other words, was working well. In Sitka, the fire department had already alerted the radio stations of a tsunami advisory for the Alaskan coast. We confirmed the information on the website of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center and put a bulletin on the air. The tsunami was not expected to be very large in our area, a meter at most, so I was not surprised when at around 9 o'clock the warning center canceled the advisory. But it turns out the warning center did no such thing. It was a computer error. I spoke with the director, Paul Whitmore, about what happened.
Starting Saturday morning during the Chilean event, our web server was hit with an unprecedented load of information requests from around the world, and it was having a hard time to keep up with that, and people may have noticed a slow response. During the event, we worked with our web service provider to increase the responsiveness of the site, and while they did that for a short period of time, when the changes were made on that site, it pulled up an old message and posted that on the site. That may have led to some confusion throughout the state as to whether or not the advisory was still on or off.
That was Paul Whitmore, the director of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. Whitmore says that on a normal day, the warning centers in Alaska and Hawaii handle about 1 megabyte per second of traffic on their websites. On the day of the Chilean quake, that number soared to 350 megabytes per second.
You know, a lot of people called me minutes after it happened, said, should we be worried?
Sitka's Fire Chief Dave Miller is the chairman of the local emergency planning committee. In small towns, sometimes word of mouth is the best early warning system. Luckily, Miller has a few other sources to rely on.
It would come over the NAWAS telephone, the National Alert Warning System telephone. We'd get a fax on it. We got an email on it, and we were also contacted by the National Weather Service.
Miller says the National Alert Warning System telephone is located in the police department, which is manned 24/7. He even gets alerts sent directly to his smartphone. Miller says he never saw the false stand down, but he heard about it the same way everyone else did, over the radio.
I got the call sometime just after you guys said that, and I went online and saw that it was, you know, not canceled because it came right back up. You know, it was only gone for just a couple minutes, and it came right back up. So my personal opinion was I was never really worried about the possibility of a wave coming at that point in time. You know, we were still hours away from any potential wave.
Miller says that despite the glitch, he's confident in the tsunami warning system. He suggested that someone from the radio station should head over to the fire hall during the next tsunami advisory to hang out and see how the system works at their end. Miller says not to expect donuts, though. His high-class firefighters prefer croissants. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Preparing seal meat isn't an activity normally associated with urban life, but a group of high school students in Anchorage recently had a chance to take part in a two-hour seminar on the subject. The class is part of the Alaska Native Heritage Center's after-school program and is offered to Alaska Native and Native American students in the city. As part of our occasional series on Alaska Native education, we have an audio postcard from the seminar. It was produced by Stephen Nowers at Alaska Dispatch.
Well, today we're butchering up a seal that someone brought in, and we're learning how to properly put it away.
They don't learn how to do this.
Oh, you're saving.
And all the generations that know how to do this,
you're saving the
pass on.
Yeah. See, this is all.
Then who's going to do this?
More.
It's important. important because, especially if you're raised on like food like this, and if you're not taught how to process the seal, then how do you expect to eat it if you don't know how to process it, if you don't know how to cook it? And how are you going to make mittens and hats and boots out of seal skin if you don't know how?
It's slimy, it's gooey. Well, the fat is hard at first, but then once you get hold of it, it gets liquidy.
So you're going to squeeze out as much as you possibly can because you don't want to eat that. No, then I'll show you how to braid it. And you're going to twist it at least twice. Put your thumb and your pointer finger through, and you're going to grab the longer one and pull it. Same process over and over. And that's how you cook the intestine after you braid it like this. Go ahead, try it. Same process over and over.
Okay.
There you go, you got it. Just make it a little bit tighter than what it is.
Just drop it in.
Who wants to try sushi?
Oh, it's cute.
Uh-oh. I bet you she threw up now. When softer.
What does it taste like?
Yari, they're coming in getting some fat now.
It tastes like chicken.
Oh, it's chewy. Okay.
It tastes like creamy.
Huh? It tastes different from cooked. It's chewy and too chewy and tastes like, starting to taste like beef or something like. It was okay.
Oh,
that audio postcard was produced by Stephen Nowers from Alaska Dispatch. To see the amazing video that goes along with it, go to alaskadispatch.com. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Stephen Nowers in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.